solve the problem of where. So moving on, well, all right, so we've now solved the problem of where everything comes from, and we understand what dark energy is. So really the only thing left is to tackle the question of, well, what is gravity? So we really would like to test gravity. Now, we've done lots of tests of gravity. There's been several Nobel Prizes given for people who've done exquisite tests to show that Einstein's theory of general relativity has passed everything we can throw out with flying colors. But we've never really pushed the theory to breaking point. Some of the tests that we've done, in fact, the 1993 Nobel Prize was one for testing general relativity with these very strange objects called pulsars. So pulsars are a naturally occurring endpoint for massive stars. When very big stars die, the outer layers explode and the core collapses down, so you get this incredible object that's only about 20 kilometers across, that's the entire object is the density of nuclear matter. One teaspoon would weigh about the same as 10,000 Sydney Harbour Bridges. These objects rotate incredibly rapidly, and for reasons we still don't really understand, shoot out very intense beams of radiation out their poles. And so if everything is lined up right, you never get, unfortunately, we don't get a picture like this, and even with a square kilometer array, we won't be getting pictures like this. But you get, if it's lined up right, then once per rotation, one of the beams will cross your line of sight, and you'll essentially measure this heartbeat coming from the sky. But the really amazing thing is that these are incredible clocks. These are more accurate, more stable than some of the best atomic clocks on Earth. And the other thing is they're incredibly stable over decades. Some of them that were discovered in the 60s are still keeping perfect time as far as the best atomic clocks in the world can tell. And the other important thing about them is that they have incredibly strong gravitational fields, 100,000 times stronger than the Sun. So if any of you ever sat through your undergraduate physics lectures on relativity and the lecturer always say, imagine we had this perfect clock and then we do all these strange contrived things in this perfect clock, and you think, well, this isn't a very practical example. Well, it turns out that we really do have these perfect clocks scattered throughout the universe. And simply by measuring the time at which each tick arrives, we can do all those thought experiments that you might have thought were simply for the imagination. And so there's some even more contrived systems, and I'm convinced that this one is made up. It's just too good to be true. But there's an actual system out there discovered here in Australia with the Parkes Radio Telescope by Australians called the Double Pulsar. So you don't just have one perfect clock, but you have two of these things, and they're in orbit around each other, and for both of them, the beams are pointing towards us. So you can take tests of general relativity to an entire new level with this incredible Double Pulsar. And it wouldn't surprise me if 20 years from now, this wins another Nobel Prize. And so just briefly, one of the things you can do is that you can do about a dozen different tests of general relativity. Each facet of general relativity makes a very exquisite prediction about how the orbit of these things will deviate from the simple orbit that Newton would have predicted. And each one of those slight deviations, whether it's speeding up or slowing down or spiraling in, allows you to make a particular prediction about the mass of one pulsar, pulsar A, and the mass of pulsar B. So for example, one particular effect tells you that the two masses have to lie on this line here. Another effect tells you that they have to lie on this line here. And just having those two tests is great because, well, these two lines only cross at one point, so you can just read off the mass of pulsar A and you can read off the mass of pulsar B. And if your goal in life was to simply measure the mass of pulsars, you could pack up and you'd be done because you've done that. But there's many more than two tests of general relativity. Just on this plot, there's about six. And what's amazing is that every single test you can come up with, each one of them quite independent, all crosses through exactly the same point. And here's a little zoom up showing you how precise you can do it. So if any one of those many lines drawn on this graph did not intersect any of the other lines at exactly the same point, you could straight away say Einstein was wrong. General relativity is pretty good, but it can't explain everything because this double pulsar is not behaving the way it should. But even this incredible system seems to follow general relativity's instructions perfectly. Every test we can throw at it is 100% consistent. Einstein certainly knew nothing about pulsars, let alone double pulsars, but his theory from the early parts of the 20th century exquisitely predicts, to the best of our measurement abilities, every single subtle detail of how this very complicated system evolves. So that's pretty amazing. It's nice to know that he was onto something on the right track. But this is certainly not the limit to which we can take things. Let's take general relativity to the next level. So instead of having a pulsar going around another pulsar, that's sort of a bit passé, let's have a pulsar going around a black hole. A black hole is the densest thing in the universe, and if you get close to a black hole, we're now talking gravitational fields millions of times stronger than the Sun's. And if you had a pulsar here in red going around this black hole, which you can't see, going around the black hole, then all sorts of weird effects involving frame dragging and cosmic censorship and black hole spin come in. yet more things that Einstein's theory predicts that we currently can't test. But if we could find a pulsar going around a black hole, and there's no reason to think such things shouldn't exist, then we could test a whole another dimension of things with Einstein's relativity. And I would not bet on whether Einstein is going to be right or not, because these are simply things that relativity has no right to be right about. So either Einstein was... We already think he was brilliant beyond comprehension, but either we're going to take this to a whole new level, or every one of us secretly hopes or find that general relativity is pretty good, but it's just a simplification of some even more amazing theory. And so we need a square combinator to do this, because firstly, these things are going to be incredibly rare. We've found thousands of pulsars in the galaxy, but a black hole, a pulsar under a black hole is a million to one thing. We need lots more pulsars before we can find the magic pulsar that will give us all the answers. But even if we had that pulsar right now, we wouldn't be able to do these tests, because the effects, the deviations of the ticking of the clock from what you expect are so tiny and so subtle that you need the sensitivity of the square kilometer array to actually see these effects. So you need the SKA to find one of these things, then you need the SKA to actually use it as a tool for gravity. But that's not all. There's another thing that Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity predicts, and it's something that is yet to be observed. And that's that if you ask, well, how does the Earth know that the Sun's telling it to orbit? What relativity says is that this is happening partly because of gravity. Objects signal each other through the emission of gravitational waves, that space actually ripples as gravity travels from one object to another. So this is a prediction of general relativity, and yet it's never actually been observed. If there is gravitational waves passing through us right now, as relativity would predict, that waves actually have the effect of squashing and stretching us. So we're all being squashed and stretched hundreds of times a second right now by gravity waves passing through us. The effect is microscopic. We're talking about stretching by less than the diameter of an atom. So how could you, on Earth, could you measure an oscillation by such tiny amounts? Well, it turns out you can do it with pulsars. Because for an individual pulse, for some of our best clocks, we can predict when the next pulse is going to arrive to better than 100 nanoseconds. And so if you think of that in terms of the distance of the pulsar, if the pulsar is, say, 1,000 light years away, that is, the light has been travelling from the pulsar to us for 1,000 years, and we can predict that 1,000-year journey to a precision of 100 nanoseconds, that essentially means that we can measure the relative distance of the pulsar to one part in 10 to the 17, in almost getting up towards a billion. So we can't measure the actual distance of the pulsar. I can't write out its distance to you. But if that distance were to change by one part in 10 to the 17, I would know. And that's exactly what you need to measure a gravitational wave, because you've got a whole galaxy filled with pulsars. And if the gravitational wave sweeps through the whole Milky Way, then as it's passing through, some pulsars will get squashed towards us by a tiny, tiny amount, and other pulsars will be stretched away from us by a tiny, tiny amount. And we will see that because the pulsars will arrive at the wrong time. So they'll arrive too early or too late. And they'll do this in a very particular way. All the pulsars over there and there will start arriving early, and at the exact time they do that, all the pulsars over here will start arriving late. So if we see... you can't just do this with one pulsar, but if we have pulsars all over the sky and they all start, the clock suddenly starts ticking strangely, but it starts ticking in a very peculiar way, as if the galaxy is being squashed this way and stretched that way, then we know that a gravity wave is sweeping across the galaxy and distorting the space between us and the pulsar. So the idea is that we could perhaps directly detect these huge gravity waves sweeping across the galaxy, both by having the incredible sensitivity of the square kilometer array to see a lot of these very distant, weak pulsars, but also the SKA, as I'll talk about in a moment, will have incredible survey speed. It'll be able to watch hundreds of pulsars at once, because there's no point seeing that pulsar do something strange and then the next day looking at that one. You have to see it all happen at once. And so you need a telescope that can very rapidly zip all over the sky, and the square kilometer array will be able to do that. I'll skip over that slide. And the last thing I just wanted to briefly emphasize is that apart from all these very carefully thought about experiments that we have in mind, we also very much, as I've said, realize that astronomy is all about finding things you didn't expect. There was a very famous astronomer of the 16th or 17th century named Hamlet who realized this, who, when he told his fellow astronomer Horatio that there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamt of in your philosophy, Hamlet realized that just because you think you understand everything doesn't mean there aren't other things out there to surprise you. Another scientist, not an astronomer unfortunately, said that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but it's queerer than we can suppose. And finally, my favourite quote from that great philosopher king, Donald Rumsfeld, who said, you know, he really missed his calling as a scientist. You've probably seen this quote before. He said, as we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But the most exciting thing for astronomers and for secretaries of defense is that there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. So I really think he captured all of science very eloquently there. And so you can really take Rumsfeld's ideas. There are known knowns. We really think there are probably strange pulsars going around black holes, and there's hydrogen in galaxies billions of light years away that we could see. So that's a known known. I mean, I can't actually show them to you, but they've got to be out there. Then there's the unknown unknowns. There's, you know, the epoch of reionization, the unknown knowns, things like the epoch of reionization. I mean, it's really got to be there. It's something we don't know, but it's got to be there. And perhaps things like weird things like merging neutron stars and alien signals. Again, I can't tell you if there are alien signals, but we know how to look for them, and we think they might be out there. But the unknown unknowns that Rumsfeld is referring to, well, who knows? I mean, obviously, I can't tell you what they are, but stars made out of quarks, or black holes like event horizons or magnetic monopoles. These might, if I give you another talk in 50 years' time, and I hope you'll extend the invitation, and I tell you the highlights of the SKA, I'd be surprised if I'm telling you about pulsars and about the epoch of reionization. I'll be telling you about Rumsfeld's unknowns, unknowns. All right, so that's the science vision. So let me finish off just by telling you about the actual nuts and bolts of it. So the defining characteristics of the SKA, it's going to be really big, a square kilometre in total collecting area. It needs to have a very large field of view. You have to be able to see big chunks of the sky at once. You have to be able to tune into lots of different frequencies, and you need to spread your collecting area over a very large extent. So the reason why you need so much collecting area is because that hiss of hydrogen from the early universe is a very weak signal. So you need a telescope 50 times bigger than anything we've ever built before. If you want to get those billion galaxies over the whole sky and you don't want to spend 100 years doing it, then you need to be able to see the whole sky very quickly. So you don't just need a telescope that's 50 times more sensitive, but you also need to be able to survey the sky 10,000 to a million times faster than anyone else has been able to do before. If you look through all those different science experiments I described, some of them will only work at low frequencies. You can only see that hiss of hydrogen down at 100 megahertz. And there's other aspects that you can only see at much higher frequencies. So we've divided up the SKA into three sort of components, the low SKA, the mid, and the high, covering more than a factor of 100 in frequency. And finally, the more you spread the SKA out, the sharper the vision you get. You don't just want to see faint things, you want to see small things too. And I won't go into the details, but you really, for some of these experiments, need to be able to make exquisite measurements of the accuracy of the position and structure of very small objects out there. So just to talk about the field of view first, just to put this into perspective, at 1.4 gigahertz, which is sort of the sweet spot for the SKA, you need a field of view which is at least 20 square degrees. So to explain what I mean by that, you've all seen the full moon. That's about half a degree across. The most powerful, most amazing telescope ever built, Hubble, well, just to put in perspective, if you pointed Hubble at the moon, you wouldn't see that. You'd see just a tiny, tiny patch of it. And ALMA, which is going to be sort of the next amazing telescope to come online, this incredible millimeter telescope, only a tiny, tiny patch of the sky at once. If you want to map the moon with ALMA, it would take you months. So here is the SKA. Here is the SKA at 5 gigahertz at a relatively high frequency. You can see you could easily gulp down the moon and much, much more. And at that 20 square degree field of view at 1.4 gigahertz is absolutely enormous. So the amount of sky you get just in one shot, this is like, you know, a 500 megapixel camera. Just the amount of sky you get in one shot is way, way beyond anything that astronomers are used to dealing with. So here is an artist's impression of perhaps what the SKA might look like. The basic idea is just lots and lots of sensors. The details of those sensors is up for debate, all connected via a very extensive fast fiber network to some incredible central processor. So we're currently evaluating three different types of sensors. For the mid and high frequencies, just traditional dishes like we use now, but with special receivers that can simultaneously cover an enormous range of frequencies, perhaps from, say, half a gigahertz all the way up to 20 gigahertz just with one single receiver. Current telescopes have a whole sort of grid of receivers sitting up there, and you have to sort of manually take one off and put the other one up every time you want to change frequencies. An alternative for the midband is a dish, again, a traditional dish, but now have a receiver which is essentially a digital camera where you can look at hundreds of different pixels on the sky at once. So you get this huge swathe of the sky. The third concept is something very different, sort of what we've got here. These are sort of passive tiles or antennas that don't actually move at all, and those are very good for doing low-frequency astronomy. And if you sort of combine these in some way, then you get these dishes, which are essentially an incredible radio camera, and these tiles, which are this less powerful system but allows you to monitor the whole sky all the time. So the way this might look geographically is that you have perhaps a few thousand dishes and tiles in a central core about 5 kilometers across, and that's about half all the steel structure, and the rest of it is scattered out in these various stations going further and further out to more than 3,000 kilometers from the core. So I'll just jump over the antennas and just talk briefly about some of the computational challenges. The amount of data we're talking about is enormous, so I won't go into the details, but if you take 3,000 antennae, and each one of which is connected to a central correlator, you're dealing with a total data rate of 7 petabits per second. You then have to multiply every one of those signals by every other signal to simulate a telescope. So you need a correlator that can deal with more than an exaflop. After that, things get very easy. You now have a mere 300 gigabytes a second coming out of the correlator, and simply to make images of it, you only need 30 petaflops to turn that into images. And then it turns into some archive so that anyone can look at it on the web, and you're only accumulating 18 petabytes per year. So the data challenges are vast. This is not only a much bigger telescope, but the amount of processing and data is beyond. And even if you wrote us the check right now, we couldn't process the data. But people are very realizing this, and there's an enormous amount of effort going into getting ready for those challenges. So in particular, Australia's leading the way here, and as part of the government's economic stimulus package, to our surprise in May, they announced $80 million for the PAWSI High Performance Computing Centre of SK Science in Perth, and this is going to be just a single, hopefully $80 million supercomputer to basically start moving towards dealing with these sort of numbers. Obviously, this computer is not going to do it, particularly if we build it today, but it's on the way. Here's another way of showing the challenge. Here is processing speed of the world's fastest computer as a function of time, the world's 500th fastest computer, and all of 500 put together. And this is sort of what we think we're going to need. So you can see, but by the time the SK takes shape at the end of the next decade, we're going to need essentially, if Moore's law holds, the premier computer in the world. So it's not crazy to throw these numbers around, but we cannot just sort of wave our hands in the air and say supercomputers. We need to be the premier supercomputing facility. And even if you have the raw processing power, there's a whole bunch of algorithms that need to be dealt with. I'm not going to talk about these in detail, but there are just whole new ways of whole new algorithms and whole new software issues that come out. You do not have time to take your data away and think about it and play with it. The data flood is coming at you, that 7 petabytes a second, and so you need to process it automatically in real time. Astronomers have never really had to do that before, and so we have to develop all sorts of automatic quality control algorithms rather than relying on the human eye to weed out problems as we do now. And I should say that several of my colleagues who in Melbourne were not able to come to my talk today because they're all in India this week. There's a whole entire international conference. This is one of a series of conferences on dealing with these issues. Astronomers are very much aware of this and are pushing a lot of the agenda in scientific computing to try and meet the challenge that the SKA is going to present. Of course, the other $2 billion question is, where do you put the SKA? Well, it has to be somewhere where you can actually spread dishes out over thousands of kilometers. You need some infrastructure, so this thing is going to need people to build it, and it's going to suck up a lot of power and going to transmit a lot of data. You don't want to put it in Antarctica because you can only then see half the sky. You don't want the atmosphere to affect the quality of the data. And the absolutely crucial thing is that you can't have it anywhere near civilization, because even a mobile phone would completely drown out the weak signals that you're trying to detect. So here is a map of the world showing you the state of play in terms of radio interference. You can see that North America and Europe and Asia are not good places to build a telescope. In fact, the whole northern hemisphere is sort of not good. But after a long evaluation, the international community determined there are two very good places to have such a telescope, Southern Africa and Western Australia. And a bit like the Olympics, someone hopefully will open the envelope and say the winner is about 3 years from now and tell us which one of those it's going to be. So the South African site, South Africa, essentially this part of South Africa is quite densely populated and this bit is essentially uninhabited, most of this. So there's an area called Karoo here that's essentially empty. And there's an enormous amount of work going on in South Africa, many hundreds of millions of rand going into developing their site and making the case for a South African square kilometre array. In Australia, I'm sure you all know very well Bulati, population 4. Somewhere here, about 7 hours drive from Perth, in the middle of nowhere, in the Midwest area of Western Australia. Very hard to tell the difference. It looked exactly the same as the Karoo site in most ways, a lot of red dirt and shrubs. And enormous amount of work going on here. There's actually now federal, state, and local legislation forbidding anyone from transmitting in this area. So we have to practice what we preach. When we go out there and develop the SKA right now, we already have a challenge in that we have to turn off our equipment because legislation requires this to be a radio quiet place, as the sign says. So, of course, that's just the core site. The full SKA spreads over 3,000 kilometres. So in the case of South Africa, that will require going way beyond South Africa into many other countries, Madagascar, Mozambique, Kenya, Ghana, and so on. I don't, of course, have no opinion whatsoever as to which site I think is better, but one difference between the two sites is that in Australia, you can have all of that 3,000 kilometres in one country. I understand that, you know, Western Australia and, you know, we're the axis of evil and they don't get along with us so much, but crossing state lines is somewhat simpler process than putting things to different countries. Having said that, however, Australia has now recently signed an agreement with New Zealand with the hope that you can make the baselines even longer and have even sharper vision by putting some dishes over here across the Tasman. So I want to finish off just by showing you what an amazing place we have in Bulati. There are very few places left on Earth where the radio spectrum is clean, where you actually aren't completely drowned out by radio signals from TVs and microwave ovens and cars and mobile phones. So would you build the square kilometre array in Sydney or Melbourne? Well, probably not. Here is the typical radio spectrum from Sydney, and you can see it's pretty bad. This is 100 gigahertz, this is 100 megahertz, and this is a gigahertz. In particular, if you recall, that signal of the epoch of reionization, that redshifted hiss from hydrogen from the first times in the universe, that's going to be at about 100 megahertz, which is conveniently right in the middle of the FM band. So you're trying to hear the universe, and all you can hear is Kyle and Jackie O. It's absolutely hopeless here. No hope of ever doing any astronomy here anywhere near Sydney. One of Australia's most powerful telescopes right now is the Australia Telescope in Narrabri, population 6,000. So things are a lot better in Narrabri. In particular, the real sweet spot for the Australia Telescope is up here, where things aren't too bad at all. But you can see that if you tried to do this experiment down in Narrabri, it'd just be hopeless. Here's Bulati, as I said, population 4, and this is really extraordinary. I mean, there are very few places on Earth like this, and most of the ones you can find are not going to look like this in 20 years, but incredibly, Bulati is radio quiet, and there is now legislation in place to keep it that way. Now, even Bulati isn't perfect. There are a few spikes, but if you zoom in on these are incredibly, incredibly narrow. They're actually only a tiny, tiny sliver of the spectrum, and you can actually just notch those out. In particular, there is lots and lots of space and very little signal in that spot where we want to see the first stars forming. So just a couple more slides. How much is the SKA going to cost? This is sort of the boring bit. Who cares about the details of budgets and all the rest of it? But the first two phases, which essentially is the SKA as I present it to you, is about 1.5 billion euros to build the thing. We were using US dollars, but for some reason the price kept going up and down all the time, so we changed it to euros. And we should not underestimate that once you build the thing, you have to run it, and that is going to cost at least 100 million euros a year. And simply the electricity, both to power the telescope and the stupendous air conditioning bill to have the stop the world's most powerful supercomputer overheating, are going to be incredible factors. Having said that, there's a $1.5 billion goal we have to get to. We're already doing pretty well. Don't worry about the details. But the bottom line is that there's already 200 million euros that's not just promised, but has already been, the checks have already been written. Australia is about a third of that. Another third is South Africa, and the other third is mainly in Europe. But there's a huge amount of effort, all being centrally coordinated by the SKA Project Development Office, or SPEDO, in Manchester. But there's an enormous amount of money all over the world. I mean, if you go up to Kevin Rudd and say, what is the SKA? He will tell you what it is. Partly that's just because he's Kevin Rudd and he knows everything. But, you know, this has reached the highest levels of government in every country. It's very much on the radar, and government's already committing hundreds of millions of dollars to it. So the road ahead, we're very much in a design phase at the moment. I'm flying off to Manchester next week to take part in this European Commission PrepSCAR program. 2012, we will figure out where it's going to be and secure the funding to construct it, and then we'll move forward into an implementation phase and then a science phase. Eventually, around about 2020 having the full SKA as I present it to you, with only the very highest frequencies missing. We're not just going to be hoping for the SKA over that period of time, but there is a whole host of SKA pathfinders taking shape. Several of them are refitting, making old telescopes new. Like here is the, this used to be the Very Large Array, but now it's the Extended Very Large Array. But the most exciting ones are taking place at the SKA sites. Meerkat, sort of a $100 million telescope to develop the single pixel broadband receiver concept. And ASCAP, the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder, being built at the Western Australian SKA site, which is developing that fisheye lens wide field concept. So there's an enormous amount of activity. These are artist impressions, but within later next year, the first dishes are going to be arriving from China, and the ASCAP is going to take shape. These are artist impressions, but they are fully funded and will be operational for the next few years. So to conclude, I hope I have given you an overview of a complex sort of billion-dollar project in only 50 or so minutes, but I hope I've convinced you that if we are able to build this incredible facility, we'll be able to understand some fundamental unsolved problems in physics and astrophysics and other more exotic things like astrobiology, the origin of life in space. We'll have a really unique way of looking at the universe. It's not just another telescope, but there are certain things like seeing the first stars turn on or testing gravity, the things you can only do using radio signals. And this isn't just for us, this isn't just for the scientists, but you know, many scientists and engineers got into what they do because of incredible experiments like the moon landing or the Hubble Space Telescope. We're going to find extraordinary, amazing things that will excite the entire community, black holes and neutron stars and gravity and all the rest of it. I think that the whole community will be enthralled and excited by how amazing the universe is and all the things that the SKA can reveal. And the bottom line, the thing that I'm most excited about, is that we will find things that we can't yet even imagine. After all, science is all about making discoveries, and there's no question that completely unexpected things will happen from the absolute moment we first turn the Square Kilometre Array on. Thank you very much for listening. I'll leave it there. Thanks very much.